to A Mindful Emergence on WPBM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPBMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation. And we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And I want to welcome our listeners into our program once again. A Mindful Emergence comes to you every week. My name is Eddie Lesher, and this week I am not joined by my co-host, Margaret Kirshner. She's taken a well-deserved night off, but I do have in my studio some guests who came all the way in from Madison County, and we really appreciate them joining us here in the WPBM studios. And that's Joanne and Bill Jenkins with Families Against Narcotics. And the theme this week is saving lives by empowering individuals to prevent and eradicate addiction. So, welcome into the studio. First of all, Joanne, how are you this evening?
I'm good. I hope you are as well.
I am.
And our listeners.
Yeah. And Bill?
I'm doing great, Eddie.
Yeah. So, give us an idea. This topic, saving lives for empowering individuals to prevent and eradicate addiction. If you could just give us an idea, what are we going to be talking about this week, Bill?
Eddie, we have an awesome thing going on in Madison County now. It's we have a Families Against Narcotics chapter that has just gone live. We are a nonprofit. And Families Against Narcotics was born out of a small meeting held in 2007 as a result of two heroin overdoses weeks apart in the small town of Fraser, Michigan. All told, that community suffered 30 overdoses that year, all to heroin. Needing to do something, and a determined group of individuals set out to recruit members and educate the public, and they formed what is now called FAN, or Families Against Narcotics. And we have a chapter now outside of Michigan. It's the first one in the South in Madison County.
Well, congratulations.
And thank you.
So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what the issue is that we're facing here. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's a really, really important one. So let's, first of all, explore what brought you to forming this local chapter and doing the work that you're doing. Perhaps we could start with you, Bill. Are you from this area originally?
No, I'm not, Eddie. I'm from Charlotte.
From Charlotte. So you're a North Carolinian.
Yes, sir.
Boy, I stumbled over that one. Mm-hmm. So you're not too far away. I mean,
no.
we get people here that have been born all over the place, and you're just down the road.
Yeah.
So how long have you been in this area?
I came here in 1997.
Okay, so it's 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it like for you growing up in Charlotte?
Well, fast. It's a whole different environment for me here as opposed to Charlotte. I came here to find recovery. And
yeah.
I was in recovery, and I tried my best to separate myself from the people in the area that was conducive to my addiction. And I came to Asheville, and I had a problem, though. I brought me with me.
Couldn't run away from you.
No.
Okay.
No, I sure couldn't.
So obviously you started using substances at some point. When and how did this get started?
Wow. Shortly after graduating high school, decided that I would just didn't know about going on to college and furthering my education. So I decided I'd just go into the workforce for a while and make up my mind which direction I wanted to go. Doing that, I took a full-time job, a second shift job in a factory in a little town called Gastonia, North Carolina. And I met a group of people that just intrigued me. And I decided, you know, hey, I would like to be in that group of people right there.
And guess what they were doing?
Yeah, they were doing the things that I definitely did not need to be doing.
Well, let's be a little more specific. What were they into?
They were into, they had progressed, so to speak, from just the casual smoking marijuana. And that's where I was when I first met them. But I noticed that they were like the cool crowd, and they were into opiates way back then.
And when was this?
This was in 1979.
Okay, yeah.
So it's been quite a while ago. That was when 1979, when I was first introduced to heroin.
Mm-hmm. So some people use heroin and they're not really interested, or they use it for a while and they stopped using. I mean, I think we know that there are many servicemen who went to Vietnam, for example. Mm-hmm. They became addicted over there, but when they came back, they no longer were addicted. What was different for you? Obviously, it became an addiction for you. Was there something from your background, from your childhood, you think that impacted this level of using?
Sure. From early childhood, I was diagnosed with depression. Mm-hmm. I felt less than. I had a self-esteem problem. And when I met this group of people, I wanted to be a part of. I just wanted to be a part of something. Mm. And as I said before, they were the cool people. Introduced me to heroin. For a majority of them, they sold heroin as mm-hmm. well, which opened another door up for me. I decided, you know, maybe I could forego school and just...
forget that.
Yeah, be the rich guy, you know, selling drugs. And it's hard to make money, though, when you're selling drugs and using the same drug.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it kind of gets in the way. Been there, done that. Okay. And what kind of consequences resulted from this?
Full-blown addiction. My gosh, before I knew it, I experienced the first lapse in the availability of heroin. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, what's going on here? I think I'm sick. And somebody says, well, they don't have to worry about calling it the flu. It's called withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. It's no picnic.
Oh, no. No, it wasn't. And I knew to alleviate that pain that I had to find something comparable to heroin, if not heroin itself. And at that time, a drug bust or something in the city of Charlotte had just dried up our supply. So we turned to synthetic heroin or a drug called Dilaudids, and which was readily available in Gastonia. It's easy to find.
What form does that come in? Is that a pill? Or?
It's a pill.
Uh-huh. Is that like something the doctors prescribe, right?
Yes, for cancer.
But you didn't go to the doctor and get it.
Oh, no. No. Gosh, fate had it. I met a person that was a big-time Dilaudid dealer out of the Queen City of Charlotte, and actually went to work for a company that he owned, and he gave me the opportunity to make even more money, sell the lot it's for him.
So where did this end up?
Prison.
Okay. Prison.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. So how long were you there?
Oh, man. In 1980, I had my first prison sentence of 2 years, did 6 months on that. I was given work release. I got a chance to just sample prison. On work release, I was able to go outside the prison during the day and then just come in at night, sleep, and go back to work the next day. Didn't teach me anything. I stayed in there 6 months and came out, and nothing really changed. All total, I did a grand total of 5 prison sentences over a 30-year span.
Wow.
So I was caught up in addiction, and not only just the addiction to the drug. I like to call it the addiction to the lifestyle.
Yeah.
I lost sense of who I was. I all direction just seemed to go down the sink. And
so were you kind of a gangster?
No, I wouldn't call it a gangster, I was a hellion, I can tell you that. Yes.
Okay, so how'd you get clean?
My last prison sentence was at the age of 50 years old, and I was given the sentence of 80 to 105 months. It's an habitual felon's sentence, and the underlying case that I got the habitual felon sentence was for breaking and entering. So I was sent off to process at a prison called Craven in the eastern part of the state. And one person in particular, it was a programmer at that prison, talked to me just like it was breaking his heart that I was there. And I could swear he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "You know something, young man? You're going to die in here."
So you met somebody in the system who gave a damn.
Yeah.
About you.
One programmer out of all those sentences.
And that made that much of a difference.
It started me in the right direction.
Got you turning.
He just told me, you know, we'll always have a place for you. You can choose to keep doing the things you're doing, and we'll bury you here with an opus number of 0207563.
That was your number?
That was my number.
I still remember my number, 26393. And I haven't been incarcerated since 1972.
Wow.
We just don't forget those numbers.
No, we don't. Yeah. It's etched in my mind.
So did you go to treatment? Did you start going to meetings? When you got out, or what happened?
It was suggested while I was in prison to go to a DART, Drug and Alcohol Rehabilitation Treatment program within the Department of Correction. However, I was never given the opportunity. It just, for some reason, a glitch in paperwork or whatever, it was never offered to me. I decided I had to make a change. I had to grow up or I'm going to die in here.
Yeah.
And this isn't, you know, for me, I found the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah. So that's called a moment of clarity.
Yes.
Yeah, that was
most
yours.
Definitely.
And you've been sober and clean for quite a while now.
Since 2006.
Good
November
for you.
Of 2006.
Congratulations,
Thank
Bill.
You. Yeah. Thank you very much.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your radio dial and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org. Let's turn our attention now to Joanne Jenkins. And Joanne, you have been working in the school system for 18 years in the Madison County school system as a teacher's assistant. You've also worked in elementary, middle school, and early college settings. So you have a lot of experience working with young people of all ages, correct?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. And along the way, you have really gotten invested in the lives of these students.
Yes.
How was your background? Sounds like it was different than your husband's.
Yes, it was. I came from a stable background, and as far as I know, no one in my family ever had addiction. After I met him, four and a half years ago, something like that. That was my first introduction to really learning about what a disease it was. And it broke my heart that someone like him could lose 30 years of your life to an addiction. And that just, that's part of the thing that makes me thrive to want to help others also.
Wow. How did you guys meet?
We met here in the big city of Asheville.
Did you now?
We did.
Wow.
Kind of clicked and...
Good for you.
At first.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because any of our listeners out there that don't know Bill, I mean, if you bumped him on the street, he looks like, you know, he, I don't know, insurance salesman or something. I don't know. It's like Mr. Rogers' buddy, you know. But that's how it is, isn't it? It's like addiction does steal our life, and it does turn us into somebody who is less than who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're showing up as who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're currently working at, let me pull it up here. I've got the website if I can get it. I love technology. Oh, here we go. You are employed at Universal Mental Health Services as a certified peer support specialist.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Oh.
What is that, and what do you have to do to become a peer support specialist?
Okay. A certified peer support specialist is someone that has lived experience either with mental health or addiction challenges.
Which you have. You qualify. Check.
Yeah. I had 29-plus years on for what the requirement is. You need to be in recovery for at least 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And you got over a decade.
Yeah.
Well over a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone one day, I didn't know what a peer support specialist was. I just knew that I was asked to be a temporary sponsor, and that went in AA. That went on to be where I just sponsored people full time. And someone says, man, you got the gift of gab. You ought to be a peer support specialist. And I had no idea what a peer support specialist was. I was working as an electrician. In the city of Asheville. So I explored what that meant. And I went to a website in the state of North Carolina and did a little research. And I said, you know, that interests me.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, I had, 4 years ago, I had married Joanne. Training for me, I had to take a week off from work and come into Asheville, and I did the 40-hour training that mm-hmm. was required. I did the 20-hour online training, but I didn't know where I fit in. So I started asking a lot of questions. How can I volunteer to figure out where I fit in? What area would I be more effective in? How can I help people and be more effective? And it was very hard to volunteer. Thank God Sunrise Peer Support mm-hmm. Services was just in its infancy.
Those guys are great.
Didn't have a building to meet in or a room to meet in. We were given Kairos West, which was mm-hmm. on Haywood Road.
Mm-hmm.
We met on Wednesdays. Just a few hours in the day, and working during the day, that was sort of hard for me to volunteer. However, I did what I could. And I just, from talking to other peer support specialists, I just knew that I would be more effective working in the community, going out and meeting people where they were.
Yeah, and that's what you do for Universal Mental Health Services here in Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also registered with the state of North Carolina as a certified substance abuse counselor, so you're involved with that program.
Yes, sir.
That's a training process for you. And you're also a community volunteer at the North Carolina Department of Public Services. What do you do over there?
Public safety.
Public safety, is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay.
I was invited to share my story at the women's prison in Swannanoa.
Mm.
Prior to doing that, I was also asked, would you like to be a an AA or NA volunteer? And I said, sure, yeah, why not? So I went to an orientation, was accepted into their volunteer program. That's a story in and of itself, an ex-prisoner going back into a prison. Mm-hmm. It's so rewarding to participate in the ladies' AA program.
And you have credibility as you stand there in front of them. So, Joanne, you came from a sort of functional background. You know, there actually are families out there that are apparently not dysfunctional, and you were in one of those. And now you do this work. I mean, you really care about these students that you work with, and you're involved with Families Against Narcotics. What was the spark? I mean, why get involved? I mean, this is hard stuff. I mean, you're dealing with people who are suffering from addiction. You're dealing with families torn apart. People are dying out there. Why take this on?
Well, I was first invited to go to the meeting when it was in its infancy in Madison County. It's been 2 years or maybe a couple months more than 2 years getting the program going and getting a tax-free status and all that going on. But my best friend's son was in addiction, and he had been in and out of rehabs. I think it was his third time, and back home and supposedly doing well. And she had to break into his bedroom and found him unresponsive and had to do CPR for 10 minutes before EMS got there, and that he was revived. And I think that was where it really hit home to me, because, you know, this was almost like, you know, my son. He was raised up with my daughter, and that was where it really hit home, and, you know, that I wanted to be involved in helping our community and our young people, and to be able to bring the resources and information that students at school that may, you know, have questions about their own families or their own addiction issues. I want to be able to help them in the future.
And the situation out in Madison County is pretty challenging. Is that one of the counties you think, or do you know statistically how Madison County compares to some of the other counties in terms of substance use disorder and overdose and so on?
I'm not familiar with numerical rankings. However, in our monthly fan meetings, we're blessed to have the support of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And we get to hear the stories of not only the sheriff of Madison County, but officers in the police department in Mars Hill and Marshall have attended, sheriff's deputies, and those stories are horrendous.
Yeah. Well, I don't know a lot about Madison County. I used to live out near there when I lived between Weaverville and Marshall. In fact, mm-hmm. I used to go for bike rides along the river, mm-hmm. and at one point I would pass a sign that says I was in Madison County. And I was looking for the bridges of Madison County, never saw them, but anyway, I know it's an old joke. But somehow I have this idea that Madison County is not as well off as Buncombe County. I don't know if that's true or not, and it seems like at least the states in our nation where there are higher rates of unemployment and poverty, the level of substance use disorder is also higher. Mm-hmm. So that's just an assumption I'm making, that it might be worse out there. But let's look at some of the numbers. I did a little bit of research today, and I was looking at 2016 statistics. Over 64,000 drug fatalities occurred in the United States. Over 64,000. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. Bill, you and I are both Vietnam War era guys. I think I'm older than you, but so more people died of drug overdoses in 2016 than all the Americans who died in the Vietnam War, just in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the information that I got, I think I remember something like two-thirds of those, or maybe it's higher, I have it written down here. 66% of those were just opioid overdoses. So that's 43,000. Mm. The highest numbers are in West Virginia, Ohio, and New Hampshire. And so the number of overdoses exceed motor vehicle deaths, exceed homicides by a wide margin, mm-hmm. exceed suicides, which have been rising steadily, largely in part to these conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and these soldiers coming back and killing themselves. What else can you tell us about this epidemic, Joanne and Bill?
Numerically, overdoses are five times higher in 2016 than they were in 1999. 46 people die every day from prescription drug overdoses.
Just prescription?
Just prescription.
So that's not the people shooting heroin and fentanyl and stuff like that. Right, just prescription.
And, you know, just in our county, very close to our home, there was a person that died from an overdose. And it was very sad that because law enforcement and neighbors knew what was going on in this home, but they weren't able to stop it. And this is within 2 miles of my home. And I think when I remember riding by that particular home, and my wife told me what had happened there just recently, and I said, man, that's really, really, really getting close now.
Yeah. Is this a young person?
The best of my knowledge, yes.
Yeah. Oh, man. You know, and I'm involved in long-term recovery, and I'm involved in 12 steps and go to meetings, and it's regularly, did you hear about so-and-so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's just left and right. It's happening. I want to ask you a question, Joanne. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, prescription drugs are the number one choice among 12 to 13-year-olds to get high, and 1 in 5 high school students report misusing prescription drugs. What have you encountered as a teacher's assistant working in the school system in Madison County?
Well, sometimes it's just as simple as this, this happened this year. It fell out of a backpack like 2 seats over from me. You know, it's just that, you know, and that really brings a lot to it. It makes you, you know, think it's there more than you realize. But there's such a stigma. No one wants to talk about it.
Hmm.
And there's something that really gets my attention. If you go on the Families Against Narcotics website, the face of the face page says the new face of addiction. And it reads, each day over 2,000 teens abuse a prescription drug for the first time. Many try it for fun, thinking they're safe. And others are prescribed painkillers by doctors, often to treat sports injuries. And for some, that decision will change their lives forever. I mean, that hits home when I read that.
Yeah, thinking about that, you know, kids playing football, soccer, basketball, any of these sports, do they have gymnastics out there?
They do.
I mean, gymnastics, a lot of people don't realize the injury rate in gymnastics, I've heard, is higher than it is in football. So what do you do when you're in pain?
Well, you go get those painkillers, and they're just being prescribed right and left. And I think it's beginning to crack down on it more and more. The doctors are not being able to prescribe it as much as they have been before. So hopefully that's going to be a change in the process of pain medication.
I just had oral surgery about a month and a half ago over at the North Carolina Community Health Center, the Minnie Jones Center.
Mm-hmm.
So and it was significant, and I was in some pain, and I asked the doctor what to do for it, and I expected her to talk about a prescription, but they have stopped prescribing opioids over there at that center. And I was really glad to hear that. You know, for my own pain, you know, I took Tylenol and ibuprofen, and that did the trick. But, you know, they've decided over there, hey, we got to stop prescribing this stuff. Is that conversation happening out there?
Oh, it is. Well, I know I had a knee replacement last year, and I would have hated to know I had to go through that without some better medication, more than Tylenol and ibuprofen. Yeah. But my family physician has told me lately that he can't prescribe but 3 days of opioid-based things for most conditions. They're really crazy.
More than 3 days?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Just three days.
Yeah.
So this is the consequences. It's like the pendulum is swinging back, isn't it? And it really needs to. I know some doctors are giving those things out like M&Ms.
Yeah.
You know, the prescriptions.
It's coming to the crackdown on it, which is sad for some patients. Like he was describing burn patients, you know, how painful it is, and then you can't prescribe it three days. So it's hurting people that need the help.
Yeah.
But
people like you who aren't addicts.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You can handle it.
Right.
Yeah. I can't. I mean, I can, but I got to be really careful.
Right.
You know, I got to be really, really careful because that I'll tell you, last time I did take Vicodin, because opioids were my primary drug of addiction. You notice I don't use the term drug of choice, drug of addiction. I remember when I took it, it was like, oh, yeah, I remember this. But I was very vigilant, you know, about how I handled it. So we're going to take a musical break, and we're going to come back and talk more about Families Against Narcotics and what you're doing out there, the work that you're doing to try to support empowering individuals to prevent addiction as much as you can. So you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on WPBMLP in Asheville, North Carolina. And I picked out a song by the Rolling Stones. And this particular song actually is not about opioids. Apparently, it's about amphetamines. Do you want to take a guess what song I'm going to play, Bill? I don't know. You're a big Stones fan?
Mm.
No, not so much?
Not so much.
Well, I think you'll recognize this song.
What a drag it is getting old. Different today, I hear every mother say, mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. Cooking fresh food for her husband's just a drag. So she buys an instant cake, and she buys a frozen steak, and goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper. And to help her on her way, get her through her busy day.
There we have the Rolling Stones, of course, and Mother's Little Helper. This is Eddie LeSure, and from 7 to 8 p.m. on WPVM, when she can join me, Margaret Kirshner and I are also joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 and Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m., when this program is rebroadcast every week, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. Here's how you find them. You go to WPVMFM.org and you select the schedule page and then click on this show, which is listed Mondays at 7 p.m., and you can listen to this and other broadcasts. This program is show number 104. We started back in November of 2015, and we're so fortunate. So many wonderful guests have been willing to come in and share their experience with us. This show is being broadcast live January 8th, 2018. So all our shows are made possible by a Mindful Emergence LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can access more information online at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And I also wanted to mention, when you're on that webpage, WPVMFM.org, if you are interested in helping keep shows like this and others on the air, keep community radio going, if it's important to you and you are able to make a contribution, there is a donate button there that you can click on and make a secure offering to help WPVM. Also, I want to mention, if you like this show, there's another program in particular I invite you to check out, and that's Thursdays at 5 p.m. It's called A Better World, where McNair Ezard brings on people and organizations working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, and the environment and spirituality. He interviews people out there who are really making a difference. So making a difference here in Buncombe County and out in Madison County are Joanne and Bill Jenkins. And in Madison County, they have a chapter of Families Against Narcotics. The theme this week is saving lives by empowering individuals to prevent and eradicate addiction. So I was wondering, Joanne, if you could give out the website so people can find out more about Families Against Narcotics.
Well, you can just go and Google FAN or Families Against Narcotics. I think that's the easiest way to find it. And when you do, there's a wealth of information on this website. There's information, there's educational resources, and there's support. You can go and click on different people's picture, and they tell their personal story, which seems to be a great help to people to see that there's people like them that have been on this route that they're on and have got help and overcome.
It's really important to remember that as many people are dying out there, there are so many more who are in recovery successfully, who are being able to find a new way to live. And they can read these stories?
Yes.
On the website?
Yes. Yeah. Or listen live, either one.
Or listen live?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Families Against Addiction was formed, I understand, 20 years ago in Michigan?
In 2007, it...
So that's 10 years ago.
Yes, 10 years ago, as a result of two overdoses with young kids in a small town of Fraser, mm-hmm. Michigan. That year, they had 30 overdoses.
Oh,
total population, 15,000.
Wow. 30 overdoses and 15,000. So how many chapters are there in Michigan now?
There's 19 chapters in Michigan.
Okay. And you became the first chapter outside of Michigan.
Correct.
And I got the impression earlier, Joanne, it took a couple of years to get this thing off the ground.
It does, because there's a lot, you know, that you have to do to join the group for one thing, but then there's a lot of legal paperwork that
has
to be done.
It's a 501c3,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
took forever, seems like.
All right, so I guess the next question is, there may be people listening who want to get involved. What do they do? How does that happen?
Well, the first Monday of each month, we have a support group meeting that starts at 7 o'clock from mm-hmm. 7 to 8, and it's at the Madison County
Cooperative
Extension Program building, which is in Marshall, North Carolina. And anyone is welcome to come. I mean, if we want you to come. If you want to help or if you have problems of your own with your family. I mean, we've had grandparents that have come, parents, people that are in active addiction. It's meant to be there for your help.
For everybody. So
if
you're in active addiction, if you're in recovery, if you're a family of someone who's struggling with addiction, mm-hmm. all of them can come and sit and talk together.
Yes.
And support each other.
Yes.
And that's every Monday at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
First Monday of every month.
Oh, I'm sorry. First Monday of every month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that address.
I'm trying to give you more work here, Bill.
That address is the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Center, 258 Carolina Lane, Marshall, North Carolina. Yeah.
But this is probably on that. If they can find the website, it's listed
correct.
On there. And also, I want our listeners to know, anytime there's information from our guests that you want to get a hold of them or need to find out more and you're not sure, you can always email me at discover@amindfulemergence.com and I'll do my best to support your needs. So what are some of the programs that Families Against Narcotics offer?
What we're just getting started, we've under discussion a very big thing for us in Madison County is to try to get a drug court established.
Mm. What is that?
Drug court, it offers an addict, a person that has committed a crime, much like I did in my past, a property crime of breaking and entering, possessions of stolen goods, even up to low level of felonies, if they can establish that they're in trouble because of their addiction, it gives them an alternative. If they qualify for drug court, what will happen is they will go in front of a judge, and the judge will sentence them to, I think it's 18 months of probation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very strict probation. Your probation officer, you have to participate in a drug court program, classes.
Good.
You have to submit to your analysis whenever.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah.
Got to go pee in a cup.
But we were very fortunate, Eddie. A few meetings back, a few months ago, Judge Thornburg from Buncombe County came and spoke with us about the drug court that they have established here. And the numbers were astounding. It was really cool to hear him talk about the successes. They also talked about the people that just didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But what got me was there was a person that was facing a sentence much like I had. He was a convicted felon, and he was facing an habitual felon sentence. He was given that opportunity to participate in drug court as an alternative to incarceration.
Gee, what a concept. Instead of locking him up and spending taxpayer money, actually maybe give him an opportunity to turn his life around and be gainfully employed, be with his family, be with community. Maybe go to meetings, get the support that he needs.
Drug courts work.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, the verdict's in.
Yeah. We had a program on drug courts over a year ago. It's really, really impressive.
I was very we had initially hoped that we could get one in Madison, mm-hmm. in Madison alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think the direction that it's going that in is they want to a greater population of people. So they're talking now, if drug court is established for us, it'll also include Mitchell, Madison, and Yancey counties.
Okay. So it'll be a collective effort?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sure. That's great. Yeah. Now, I'm looking at the website for Families Against Narcotics, and they have a program now. You may not have it here, Joanne, but it's called Hope, Not Handcuffs. Can you say anything about that?
Well, I've read that, and I mean, that is just amazing. I mean, we've been locking up addicts for years, and it really hasn't helped anything. I guess that's kind of what the drug court is kind of, that is what it's,
designed to do.
Sort of, yeah. Yes.
Modeled in that fashion. In Michigan, that particular program, if someone recognizes, hey, man, I've got a problem and I need some help, they can go to a police station. They can go to the FAN website, the Families Against Narcotics website, and you can request help. They're not going to lock you up. What's going to happen in the participating counties in Michigan is the police department's going to call a person they call an angel. An angel is a member of FAN. He's been trained. He or she's been trained. They're going to come to the jail or the police department or wherever this person decided to request assistance. In recovery, and they're going to talk with them, and they're going to offer viable alternatives to them. They're going to offer treatment to them because they have those resources right there with them. And they're not going to leave them there. They're going to stay with them until they can get them placed in the treatment facility.
Boy, that's fantastic. I just had, again, that image of that guy that was in that, when you were locked up, who just really gave a damn. It's kind of the same thing. It's like, wow, somebody actually is trying to help me rather than just lock me up.
Yeah.
It can make all the difference in the world.
It did for me.
Yeah. Do you guys do presentations? I mean, would you go somewhere and talk about this? I mean, has that been part of what you do yet? I know that this is still in its early stages in Madison County, but I mean, what if somebody, would you go and talk to, you know, whether it's with Families Against Narcotics or otherwise, would you go and do presentations at churches, community centers, or any place like that?
Yes, we would, definitely. The company that I work for, Universal Mental Health Services, just recently gave permission for some of my coworkers to go to the Madison County Early College to talk with their students about addiction and about recovery as well. Put on about an hour presentation. There were three presenters. Thank God we have some young people in our company that were able to just connect. Mm-hmm. And from what I'm hearing, they did connect, and they people heard. They listened and heard.
Now, this was through Universal Healthcare, not so much through the FAN program.
Right.
But I know that in Michigan, apparently, they've been able to get to the point where they can develop presentations through FAN, and you hope to do that as well.
Yeah, it started with some young kids, a couple of the young addicts that first night in the room stood up and said, let us talk to the to the kids. Maybe, just maybe, they'll listen to us. And with that hope, the organization sprouted wings and took off. Within a month, FAN was speaking to every student in Fraser High School. Every student. Young people in recovery, parents who lost loved ones, real people sharing real stories. And we haven't stopped sharing our stories since. And that's a very big part of FAN,
sharing the stories. What does that do? I mean, how does that impact people?
Erasing the stigma is one of the big things in Madison County. No one wants to talk about addiction or admit that they have a problem, or it's kind of just a taboo thing to talk about. And if we can erase the stigma of it, we've made a big gain right there, because that's a big part of the problem, seems to be.
Does it seem to matter what economic level they are, or what social stature their family has? You notice much difference?
I don't know, not really. It's just no one really wants to talk about it. They don't want to admit it. And until we can get out there and make the dialogue, you know, normal dialogue to talk about, it's mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to help. And that is one thing that the fan group is planning on doing. I mean, any church group or anyone listening, if you have an organization or a group that you would like for someone to come and speak to, and just get in touch with us, and we'll be able to organize it and get it going.
What's the best way to get a hold of you?
You could reach us. The best way? Is come to one of our meetings.
Yeah. Give us that information again.
Okay. It's at the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Center. The address for that extension center is 258 Carolina Lane. It's in Marshall. It's right near the fairgrounds.
And when is it?
Every month, the first Monday, and the community support mm-hmm. Part of our meeting starts at 7, runs to 8:30. Just, we'll talk with you as long as you'll stay.
Yeah. So, we talk about the stigma, Joanne and Bill. And by the way, I just want to remind our listeners again, this is a Mindful Emergence on WPBM FM 103.7. Joanne and Bill Jenkins are my guests this week from Families Against Narcotics. So, do you talk to students sometimes out there, Joanne, and they confide in you, and maybe they haven't confided in somebody else?
So far, there hasn't been a lot of that, but, you know, it's kind of in its infancy now, and but I hope in the future that is going to be something that's going to happen.
You must see evidence of problems out there.
Oh, you do. You do.
Yeah.
And it just breaks your heart, because some of these, you've had them when they were in second grade, and they're kind of like your kids, too, and it just breaks your heart to see this happening.
See them start running off the rails?
Yes.
Yeah. So, parents, if you have advice for parents who might be concerned at their children, and children is like as young as elementary school, I'm sort of not laughing, but I remember once hearing someone say that they got clean at 12.
Wow.
I mean, they started using earlier and actually mm-hmm. got clean at 12. So, I mean, if parents are concerned that their children are using, what indications, what signs, what should they be looking for? And I don't know, I'm kind of dropping this on you. I haven't really told you I was going to ask you this question. But, I mean, how would they talk to their kids? What would be something they could do to try to help the situation?
Well, the first thing, if something doesn't seem right, is to talk. A lot of times it's kind of one of those conversations you just don't want to believe it's true and kind of push it under the carpet. The beginning to help is to talk.
What would they say? I mean, you don't want to put them on the defense right away, right?
Well, you want them to know that it's okay to talk. I mean, if you have a problem.
That's the key.
Yes.
It's okay to talk.
It's okay to talk.
You're not in trouble.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just.
Because you can't fix a problem you can't talk about.
That's true.
That's a truth. Bearing the problem and keeping the secret is only going to perpetuate the problem and the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Addiction is clearly a disease, and it happens to people in all walks of life, ethnic backgrounds, and yes, it's in all of our neighborhoods. Madison County being so small, everybody seems to know someone,
mm-hmm.
everyone else. And, you know, that there again, that word stigma is such mm-hmm. a barrier. It
I'm convinced. When I came clean with my parents and said, look, you know, I've got a problem. And it's something that you probably have never experienced, and it's called addiction. I'm strung out on heroin, and I don't know what to do. Gosh, man, it was like, oh, Lord, don't tell anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Not in this neighborhood. Until we can get out and talk about these things. Many of us never thought drugs would be an issue in our lives, but they are now. And we're at a loss of what to do, who to talk to, or where to turn. There's no easy answers, and we wish there was a magical cure. But until there is, we have each other and our shared experiences to help us through some very difficult times.
Mm-hmm. Has the faith community gotten involved with this at all, or do you have hopes to bring the churches into this? You know,
we have had several church leaders that have come to meetings in through this program. And one thing that we haven't talked about, our clerk of court, Mark Cody, was one of the instigators in getting this program started. And if anyone has a problem, if you go to this office, to the clerk of court's office, I can guarantee you will get help.
Is that in Marshall?
Yes, mm-hmm. at the Marshall Courthouse. Because
mm-hmm.
they want to help this problem. They've been very instrumental in getting this started. Actually, someone in the clerk of court's office was the one that found the FAN organization and got us into it.
Nice. Nice. Well, as we near the end of the program, I've got something in my hand that's been sitting on the desk. It's called an opioid overdose prevention and survival kit. And it's something I carry because I'm a substance abuse counselor and I work in the field. How important is the availability of this Narcan, Bill?
I think it's very important. Just recently, the health department in Madison County gave out some Narcan kits. If I'm not mistaken, our police, sheriff's department carries Narcan. And just recently, a lady that I know, her son and had a Narcan kit in his car and went to a service station just to purchase gas. Paid for his gas, went into the bathroom, and there was a fella in there that had fell out. Mm. It was laying in the floor and clearly in distress. He identified that problem right quickly and ran back to his car. Thank God he had a Narcan kit in his car, and administered that Narcan kit to the person as the store personnel, salespeople were calling 911. When they arrived, they said he was instrumental in saving that man's life. And that in and of itself says volumes to me.
So that's not a component part of the FAN program, having these kits.
No.
But it's certainly something that supports what you're doing. It's another resource in the community. It's something that, I mean, it seems to me that would be a great thing to have in the schools. Do they have them in the schools? Has that been talked about, Joanne?
Oh, it has. I think they're readily available.
Are they?
Just, yes.
Okay. Wow. Well, I'm so grateful for the two of you. I know that you had long days, and you've come in here and shared this about Families Against Narcotics. And I know your program is in the early stages. It's going to continue to grow and thrive. And I know with absolute certainty you're already making a difference in people's lives out there. And thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you so much for having us.
So again, thanks to Bill and Joe and Jenkins for coming in this week on A Mindful Emergence. And I just want to remind you that next week, my guest is going to be Lisa Boucher, talking about doctors, nurses, and healthcare, what they don't know about addiction. And she's an author, and that's going to be a really interesting show as she lends her perspective to the situation. And thanks so much for joining me. We'll see you next week.
WPVM LP 103.